It's now the 1st of November 2011, and I'm continuing the interview with Kate Moore. Kate, can I go back a little bit and just ask you to comment a bit more about how ALP factions and their factional politics might have affected your work while you worked in the ALP central mm-hmm. head office?
Well, one always had to be very conscious of the factions and the power plays within the factions and between the factions and how they were going to affect you, the business that you were working on at the time. One of the key ways for me was because I was the national organiser, brackets female, I had charge of overseeing the party's affirmative action programme, which was basically aimed at encouraging more women into the parliament and within the various positions within the party. We aimed to get, I think it was about 30% of women into parliament, 30% of the positions in parliament held by women eventually. And this, of course, was affected by the operation of the state branches and the factions within those state branches, so that many of the women activists, the women who actually wanted to go somewhere and were very passionate about their politics, were very involved also in the factions. So that inhibited them supporting women in other factions. So in order, you know, if a woman was standing for pre-selection, say from, and she was from the left, then the women from the right would not vote for her. They would vote for a man from the right in preference to the woman from the left. And yet at the same time, they would all be talking about the importance of getting women into the parliament and of women supporting other women. And at times it was my job to remind them that there was a little bit of, not hypocrisy, but a bit of double speak in all this, that they really needed to put their votes where their passions were or where their mouth was. But of course, the reality of politics is that you will support the person who stands for what you think you stand for. So that's the key way in which the factions affected the work I was trying to do.
What was one of the factions or either of the factions more likely to support women in getting into parliament and being, you know, supporting women's causes than another? Or were they both fairly much the same?
My memory is they were both fairly much the same. I think probably the left faction was perhaps in words more committed to affirmative action, but I don't think that intent went into practice a great deal more than it did in the right. I guess the centre-left was always seen as the middle way, and that perhaps they were more likely to support women. But I don't have the numbers in my head about the number of women seeking pre-selection and where those votes came from.
So did you see your job in any way as involving twisting of arms to try to make sure that women were supported more than they had been?
It was very hard to twist arms because in the national office you actually had very little power. So my the arms with which to twist other people's arms were fairly weak. But we relied more on the power of persuasion, logical argument, etc., etc.
And were you supported in this by any members of the national office? Any people there who were very much pro?
Oh yes, Bob McMullen, the then national secretary, was very, very supportive of encouraging women into politics. Very supportive, and he gave me a lot of backing, and in fact prompted me to give people a bit of a poke if they were saying one thing and doing another. So he was wonderful, wonderful to work for.
You mentioned in notes that you've written before the interview that you were a frequent visitor to Old Parliament House during your time as national organisers from mm-hmm. 1983 to 87. What was the purpose of those visits to the building?
It was usually often to do with the policy work that we were doing at the national office, because we ran a number. The parties always had a broad policy agenda serviced by national policy committees, so it might be to go and talk to a relevant minister or backbenchers about that policy. For me, there was a fair bit of liaising with some of the women members of parliament because of my particular duties as a female organiser. I would talk to Susan Ryan a fair bit about the work that I was doing, and she was very encouraging, very supportive. There was a lot of dealing, obviously, with ministerial staff over policies and politics, what the ministers were doing, how we needed them to campaign, whether we thought where we thought the government needed to position itself in relation to any particular issue, because of course, I mean, parties do polling. We didn't do as much as they do nowadays, but we would get feedback from our party members and from the electorate, and we would make sure that the ministers and the backbenchers knew what was coming through for us.
Mm. So it was for briefing purposes mainly.
It was briefing, yes, and at times they would brief us on difficult issues that were coming up. I remember, for example, Neil Blewett's office, when Medicare was being introduced, would tell us what was going on, and they asked us. I mean, they would give us a briefing around the big publicity campaign that was being planned and ask for our input into that. When the AIDS virus first surfaced and there was a lot of public concern, they ran some of the advertising material past us in the Secretariat to make sure that, A, that we knew about it, and B, that we couldn't see any adverse impact for the party, or if there were, that we could prepare ourselves for it. So there was a close working relationship with the Hawke government overall.
So you would have visited many parts of the building at the time.
Yes, it was a real rabbit warren, and we got to know our way around and become quite familiar with the place.
How was, out of curiosity, what was access to the building like? Was it controlled security that you had to go through?
I don't remember. I really don't remember having any security checks. But I think if they were quite cursory. I think that it might just have been that we had a card and showed it when we came in. But I don't remember any really tight security at that time. Not as tight as it is now.
Mm. What was your, I suppose, first impression of Old Parliament House as a building when you came here?
When I came here, I was it was probably in the early 1970s when I first came into the Old Parliament House. And I was quite intimidated because I'd never been into a parliament house before. I'd never met a politician. So the whole thing was a little overwhelming. Over time, as I became more familiar, I really enjoyed coming into the building. It has a lovely atmosphere. There was always a bit of a buzz around it. There were people busy, people, interesting people to talk to, people doing things, and a sense of occasion when you were here.
Well, now we come to 1987. Tell me, how did it come about that you joined the staff of the minister, then Minister for Community Services and Health, Neil Blewett?
Well, I had been working for the Labor Party for 10 years. I thought that was probably long enough. I'd been a national organiser for 4 years. I had become more and more interested in policy, and I thought it was time to move on. But the problem for me was that there were very few places that were interested in employing an ex-Labor Party apparatchik. So I didn't see many career options arising for me. So I decided that the only way out was to go and work in a minister's office and see where that took me. It wasn't something I particularly wanted to do. I'd seen a lot of, obviously, a lot of ministerial staff. I'd seen the way they had to work. it wasn't particularly attractive to me, and I didn't particularly want to work under those pressured conditions and the long working hours. But nevertheless, I thought, well, it'll be interesting. So I rang a few ministers, ones that I thought I would be happy working for, and they were mainly the ones that I thought would challenge me slightly and who I respected because I'd known them, most of them, for some time. So I rang probably three or four of them, and Neil Blewett said, "Oh, come and see me now." So I went to see him, and he offered me a position as an advisor on his staff. Obviously, I knew Neil. I'd worked with him before. He knew me. And that's simply how it happens.
No interview, no any.
I came and had an informal chat to him, but no. No.
When you started, what was, or how did he describe the kind of job that he expected you to do for him?
Well, he didn't. I knew I was going in as an advisor, and it was shortly after the 1987 election. He had had an expanded portfolio. In the first Hawke ministry, he was purely and simply the Minister for Health. In 1987, Hawke created the system of super ministries. So what Blewett got was health plus a whole lot of community services portfolio. And so he was looking for advisors in the community services side of things. And I was asked to advise him on aged care and childcare in particular. And so they were the two aspects of the portfolio that I took on. Now, I knew a little bit about childcare, obviously, having been the women's organiser and been involved in some policy development around that, and it being one of the issues that was close to the hearts of the women's movement. But I didn't know a lot about aged care, so I went on a very, very steep learning curve.
And what was the, within the office, how did you fit in?
Well, I knew some of the staff already. I knew his press secretary, and I knew a couple of the advisors vaguely. I knew his senior private secretary. So there wasn't a big hassle about fitting in. It was the physical fitting in that was the problem. The offices in those days were very, very small. Neil still had the office he'd had since becoming a minister, and yet he'd got his portfolio size had doubled, and his staff had increased by three or four people. So we sat, his advisors and the press secretary, sat in one office, a fairly small office. We probably had about 2 or 3 feet of desk space each, facing a wall, and behind us was a bit of a corridor with a very large photocopier in it. And it was the area where people waiting to see the minister would stand because there was nowhere for them to sit. So I would normally be trying to do my work with the phone ringing, with phones ringing throughout the office, and with a photocopier going behind me and a queue of bureaucrats waiting to see the minister. It was not the best way to work, I thought.
How many people were there on this staff at the time you started?
There must have been about 10, I think, 10.
Can you remember what their roles were?
Well, there were people advising on various aspects of the portfolio. There was the senior private secretary, as they were in those days, who ran the office basically and made sure that everything went through to the minister on time and in good form. There was the press secretary. And then there was his personal secretary who controlled his diary, and a couple of stenographers and some poor people. And then, of course, there was the driver who was not normally in the office but would often be there waiting for the minister to come out.
Mm. There was by the time you've, again, just while we're talking on size of staff, you actually remained a member of his staff, and you were senior private secretary from the last 2 years. You were there from 1988 to 1990.
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember what increases in staff there might have been over the time when you moved up to the new building, or did the staff remain the same?
The staff remained virtually the same because we were moving up to the new Parliament House, or the new Parliament House was built because the current one really wouldn't hold the number of people working there. So the size of the staff remained the same. We just had more space to work in.
The structure of the office, was that such that when the matters that you were supposed to advise the minister on, did you advise him directly or did you advise him through his senior private secretary?
No, we would normally advise him directly. There was just a lot of routine paperwork that we did. So we would process the paperwork and it would go onto his desk. If there was anything that we thought was a little controversial or a little odd, then we would talk about it amongst ourselves. I mean, particularly with the senior private secretary. Mm. So it was really about using our nose to determine what was for greater consideration and what was just a routine briefing from the department. Mm.
So, but you had a direct relationship with the minister.
Oh yes.
Yeah, and on the matters that you were.
Yes.
Would you ever step outside the realm those two, aged care and childcare portfolios, or part of the portfolio?
Only in discussions within the office. Mm. So I if there was any paper coming through, it would on those topics, it would not normally come to me. It would be raised by one of the other advisors. Mm. And then we might have a general discussion around it.
Did you have a regular staff meetings within the office at all?
No. No, not for the... No, because we were all so crammed in together, we were sort of almost meeting all the time anyway. And life in those offices is somewhat chaotic because of the nature of the political process. And so you're very much responding to issues of the minute. So every day when the Parliament's sitting, your first job is to go through the question time brief and make sure that all the possible issues that the minister might be questioned on that day are covered. And are covered in a way that obviously puts the government in a favourable light. So, there was very little time set aside for things like staff meetings. You just couldn't do it.
When you were an advisor, how did you see the senior private secretary's role, the senior person? Did you see that person as someone running the office, or simply a facilitator, or the senior advisor on everything?
I saw her, I guess, as what she was doing was being the senior advisor and keeping an eye on the politics and the policy, and to some extent the office. She was a journalist by training, and I think the journalist training is not about administration and management, it's about the policy and the politics. And that's what she did.
It's an interesting comment because an interview I had with a chief of staff, senior private secretary of a prime minister. He said that he saw the role as making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
That was as the head office, the head person's role. Mm-hmm. How would you react to that description?
Well, I think that's how I saw myself in that role. When I assumed the role, I saw it as making sure that everything that needed to happen happened, and that the infrastructure was in place to do it, so that the staff were alerted to issues that were coming up, that the minister's diary was logical and doable, so that there were spaces between appointments, there were spaces for reflection for the advisors to talk to him, there were spaces for him to catch up with the paperwork. So I saw when I took the role on, I guess I'd learned from working with another senior advisor and had time to think about what needed to be done. And so I think I took a more managerial role, as well as a political and policy advisor too. about making sure everything happened and happened on time.
How did it come about that you became took on the role of the senior advisor?
Well,
the senior private secretary.
Deborah was leaving. She announced that she was leaving. She gave some notice that she was leaving, and Neil asked if I would be interested in doing it. I said yes. I mean, one doesn't say no to that sort of offer, does one? I was a little surprised, but flattered and ready to step in, I thought. I'm very intimidated by it. I didn't have a background in health policy, and I had managed to ease my way into the community services side of things, but I still felt uninformed about health policy.
How did you go about getting to be a knowledgeable and expert in that area?
I've always been a great believer in learning by doing, so it was about plunging in. It was about listening to the advisors. It was about listening to the minister and then drawing some conclusions for myself about what was the appropriate way to go. I think one of the things I had to do early on was to establish my authority with the department, who I suspected were not always, or trying to co-opt me perhaps. And yet I knew that the job of an advisor was not to be the minister's, was not to be the department's voice, but to be another source of advice to the minister, or at times when that was necessary. And there was one occasion when I thought the department was trying to heavy me. And it was when the minister was overseas and there was a particular proposal that was on the cabinet agenda and would come up, I was told, while he was away. And therefore I was asked to clear the cabinet submission. And of course that was in the days before we had email and mobile phones. So the minister was in Europe, so it was quite difficult to contact him. And I knew that this cabinet document would be highly contentious, and in my view it shouldn't have been there. And the particular person in the department kept ringing me and saying it had to be cleared and I needed to clear it, and if I didn't clear it then the whole of the cabinet would come down on my head. And I looked again and I thought about this and I thought about it. This is dangerous. And so I made a couple of phone calls to people I knew, and the next thing we knew, the thing was off the cabinet agenda and never reappeared. And I think that helped to establish my credibility with the department.
I was going to ask about
that. There was a different relationship after that.
I was going to ask about that, the general relationship between the private office and the department, and I suppose other government agencies also.
Mm-hmm.
How did it work? And how were you?
It was very good. It was most of the time. It was very good. I was very impressed by the majority of the bureaucracy. I thought they produced good papers, good advice. Equally, they worked closely with the office, and we had good relationships with many of the senior bureaucrats. So it was a good constructive relationship. I learned a lot from it.
Was contact between the department and the private office always through the yourself as the senior person?
No. And many of the public servants would ring the advisor in their area directly because relationships had been established. So when I was working as an advisor on childcare, I had and aged care, I knew the senior bureaucrats directly, and there would be a lot of contact between us. So It was a good relationship, I thought, and it was a good way for the office to operate.
I'm intrigued by you mentioned the case about you felt the one case they might have tried to monster you in a sense, the submission. How did it come about that you as a staffer was asked to endorse a document that was going to go to cabinet rather than acting minister or whoever might have.
I think that's a very good point. I don't know why they. I don't think we actually had junior ministers at that stage, and so they were junior. They weren't familiar with the topic in question. It was essentially a political decision, I felt, that had come about through, you know, through the economic rationalist push. And while I had some understanding and sympathy for the economic rationalists, I thought this particular proposal was politically very dangerous. And so I wasn't prepared to let it go anywhere else. and I did, when I did manage to speak to the minister, I told him what I was doing or what the push was. And he basically said, well, he couldn't do anything about it from where he was because there was no way he could get hold of the document. So I handled it the way I felt it should be handled.
It's an interesting angle you mentioned too. That this you said this was almost fully a political decision.
Yes.
Was that part of the brief of staff to deal with?
Yes, we're there as political advisors, and our eye is to run our eye over things with a political eye and with a political antennae, so that we would pick up any problems that might arise or be facing the government if a particular policy or action were decided upon.
In a case like this, it also raises a question about how did you manage to coordinate the efforts of the other advisors in the office in a situation where staff from the department could easily contact the advisors direct and maybe with between them agree on a certain approach. Which did they clear things with you before they?
Yes, if there was anything contentious, I think we operated on a basis of a lot of trust between the advisors. Obviously, there was some rivalries because people in those positions are ambitious. but no, I think there was trust, and you know that once there's an issue that might be political, then it's best talked through with other people with similar experience or similar views. And we would sit around and talk through an issue and usually come to an agreed position.
So the coordination of efforts was really by this more informal consultations and talk within the office?
Yes, yes.
And not on a hierarchical structure at all?
No, not.
That the decision was made by you as the head of the chief of staff, so to speak.
Well, I think I was more coordinating the making of a decision because usually it would come down to what advice we as the advisor were going to offer the minister.
Mm. Mm. Back to the minister, how would you describe your relationship with him?
It was a good relationship. I enjoyed working with Neil because he was so bright. He was so intelligent that he was always one step ahead of his advisors, and so it constantly kept us on our toes. So that was one aspect of it. Was the other, because you inevitably, when you're working very closely with people, you get to know them pretty well, and we could tease him and have a laugh and share a joke amongst ourselves. So go back to your original question, Edward. Sorry.
Well, that was how you saw your relationship with the minister.
I had a lot of respect for him. A lot of respect. he came from an academic background, and he listened to his advisors. But in the end, he always made up his own mind. But he listened to his advisors with a great deal of respect, and would talk through an issue with us.
Mm.
He was mostly very, very good like that.
Were there any times when you strongly disagreed with the minister, that he strongly disagreed with the advice you gave him?
Once or twice that I don't particularly want to go into, but there was one occasion where he and I had come to an agreed position involving appointing somebody to a committee, and I think I took an evening off of work, and when I came back in the next day, he'd been persuaded to overturn that decision, and I expressed my displeasure. And the decision, the later decision was reversed. But that was really the only time I can remember any conflict.
Talking about the office again, when you were the senior staffer, the coordination of the work of the office as a whole, from what you were saying, you focused quite a bit on that and making it happen.
Yeah, I was making sure that the work was able to be done, that it flowed through, that the paperwork came in from the department was processed within the office. That we knew where that piece of paperwork was, or we could track it down if we needed it quickly, that it went through to the minister in a timely way, and that it went back to the department. That was the sort of circular flow of paper. But there was also the coordination of his diary, making sure that his commitments were reasonable. And one of the things I always felt very strongly about was that his work commitments were such that he was enabled to get home for most weekends, so that he kept some touch with reality. I had seen ministers who didn't get home for weeks on end, and I knew that that spelt problems for their family life. And it was also those ministers who perhaps had lost touch with their electorates and with real people. And I felt there was a danger keeping ministers in Canberra or surrounded by their advisers for too long. Mm. So I always tried to make sure that he had his weekends off, and that we didn't take on too much on his behalf.
Mm. In terms of doing that coordinating, did you every morning, so to speak, go through the day's work or?
Yes.
Or what was on, and talk to all the advisors and all the staff to make sure, and then do anything and coordinate it that way? Or was
well, that? I would keep an eye on his diary so I would know what was coming up. I think I had a fair idea of what was on the policy agenda so that we knew what was coming up. We would know what was coming up in Parliament. We would all see the question time briefs. So there were a lot of ways in which you coordinate and keep an eye on what's going on.
Mm. Mm. So no formal meetings, no formal staff meetings or anything like that, from what you were saying?
I can't remember having any formal staff meetings. I think we had morning teas and things when the minister was away. And those of us who were left would have morning teas together or coffees together.
Yeah, that brings me to another issue. In the sense, I suppose this might be an impossibility, but can you describe a typical day as working in the minister's office, well, from your perspective?
I don't think there is a typical day, because they differ. When the parliament's sitting, it's much busier. When the parliament was sitting, we would come in probably somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning. The press secretaries would have been in much earlier. We would each have a copy of the media clippings on our desk, and we would go through those, pick out any issues that looked to be difficult. We'd go through the question time briefs to make sure that they were covering those issues, that we had responses to any questions we might be asked in the parliament. And then the day would begin with a series of interest groups, bureaucrats coming to meet with the minister, interrupted frequently by the ringing of the bells and the minister having to dash down the hallway into the chamber for a vote. So it was both routine and chaotic, because one never knew what was going to come up, of course. In the parliament, one could never completely control what was coming up in question time, etc., etc. When the parliament wasn't sitting, I think things were a little more relaxed. The minister would normally not be in Canberra, maybe in Adelaide with one or two of his advisers, or he'd be on the road somewhere speaking at a conference or visiting a nursing home or opening something here or opening something there. So the Canberra office would be much more relaxed, still very busy, but perhaps without the minute-by-minute pressures that we experienced when the Parliament was sitting. And maybe one or two of us would be travelling with the minister at any one time.
So one or two of you, was that something you did in rotation or just to sort of have a...
It would depend on what he was doing. If he was visiting a nursing home, then his aged care advisor would be with him. If he was visiting a health facility, then maybe one of his health advisors would be there. So it would depend, and if he was speaking at a conference, it depended what the conference was about. One of the advisors would be there, and often the press secretary would be with him as well.
So your own day, I mean, one of the questions that I'd like to ask is also, in sense, how did you manage to have a break? Where did you go to have lunch or dinner or breaks or whatever? Did you have that in the office always? Or?
I tried not to. One of the things I tried to do with the office was to say that we all have to stay sane here and that we must all have breaks. And one of the things I did institute was a roster system so that when the Parliament was sitting, we weren't all there every evening until 11 or 12 o'clock at night, so that a couple of advisers would be rostered on for each evening and the rest of us would go home maybe about 7 or 8 o'clock. And that was purely in order to reduce the fatigue levels. Now, that wasn't entirely uncontentious. I think many